We'll start with a few more minutes quiet together. Would anyone like to ask or share something? She's saying, I mentioned before that the emotions are not the driver. I think I said we're not able to drive it when we see our emotions not doing what we want them to do. We can have the insight that we're not in control of our vehicle, that it's not that kind of vehicle. But maybe you were thinking of another moment, something else I said. So if the emotions are not the driver, who is the driver? If the mind is not the driver, who is the driver? Yeah. Okay. There are a lot of ways that the way we live is kind of like a robot, like artificial intelligence. The programs run, buttons are pushed, and the same reaction happens. And in that case, I'm not sure if someone's driving. The past is driving. But actually what I would like to talk about today is having our freedom. And so the possibility of not living just programming. And so in a moment where the programming is not in charge of our life energy, what is that like? Or when the programming is in charge but something is a little bit aware. So earlier I talked about that there could be a kind of okayness that has room for not okayness, or even a whole basket of different kinds of not okay, as well as every other experience. I think that your question, who might drive or who might be driving, can really take you deep. I think it's worth letting it be an open question. So sometimes questions come up and they more like close us off from life, or they close down. So we could ask the question, who's driving this thing, in a way that we don't really care. We don't have the energy to be interested if someone is driving and where the energy is coming from and why. So if you hear yourself in the mind or out loud saying a question like, why do I always get angry when, or why do I always feel small when, then hearing in the tone of voice and feeling in the tone of the body that it's not really a question. It's a weapon. But the same question we could later on open. Can you imagine being curious about your program? Why do I, not always, but usually, get angry when I have to wait in line for more than a few minutes? And sometimes that opportunity, there's some openness and we care. Or it can happen through a feeling of we don't care. So why not find out? Sometimes we care too much to be able to really feel compassion and be interested in what's going on and what's driving our suffering. So if we take the question, who is driving? We could maybe start better with the word driving and get some experiential sense of what it's like to be driven. We came to the retreat and we wanted some deep rest. And maybe sometimes there is some when we're not looking for it too much. And maybe there's tons of agitation. Or you thought, oh, finally I can lie down for meditation. I won't have to deal with body pain. And like, oops. Sometimes there isn't, sometimes there is. Or lying down and it's too loose. It's so open. Someone described today noticing the difference between sitting and lying down. He said, when I'm lying down, I can't define what I'm doing or what's happening. And then the contrast maybe in sitting is it's so easily defined. I am doing it. And so if you accept the invitation to play with lying down sometimes, if it suits you, okay. Or to bring some of that feeling of maybe don't define it too much. If you're sitting up, bring some looseness to the sitting. lying down, and it's not easy to define what's happening or who's doing something. And a lot happens. And I like the metaphor of if we would have maybe lost the feeling in our lower half of our body or something, and we were slowly training to get back the feeling, to be able to feel and move our lower body. It wouldn't matter how much we studied about neurology if we didn't practice something and be really bad at it, really trying to move a big toe and not being able to move a big toe, trying to feel an ankle and not being able to feel an ankle. So one step or one part of having our freedom is awkwardness. Is there a word in Hebrew for awkward? Mozarut. Sirboul. Sirbal. An example of awkward is this moment, like I have no idea what the Hebrew is, and there are a few options. And it's sometimes scary to say something out loud in a room, and can be awkward. Like, is there a right answer? Is there, and none of them are exactly right, and that's okay. Or maybe another example of awkward would be an acceptance that here we are in the Dharma talk of the retreat, and we're not going to explain and understand everything. That's not going to happen. Gautama Buddha said, and he lived into his 80s or so, teaching. He said, this handful of leaves compared to this forest is what I have taught, compared to what there could be to teach. And I am not Gautama Buddha. So there could be extreme enthusiasm to learn and to understand everything. And then, we can't make that be the way that we might have imagined. And so it's awkward to not give up and also to accept that we can't have it the way we imagined. And so back to driving, we can be have an enthusiasm or an interest or a need. Maybe there's a question that's really alive for you. And that can come about from a life situation that is wonderful or terrible or both. Or it can just come. And how to have that unsettling question without settling for an answer too soon. It's awkward. And it would be easy if you ever had a question like, what is this? Or who's driving? It would be easy to feel so unsettled by having a question and not having an answer that there could be a driving you crazy. Driving, you've got to have an answer. it's important to check in there where there could be something driving that comes from fear and lack. If a question or a situation bothers you and you want some kind of solution or resolution, but you really want it in a driving way, like really pushy way, checking what is driving the question. What's driving you crazy? What's the push? It can be partly culturally, it's considered to be powerful to have the answers rather than the questions. Culturally, we've trained that if we have the answer, we can relax. And so much so that we'll accept any answer sometimes. Oh, I saw it on YouTube. Someone said. And then we shape our lives around that. And we forget that question that might have helped another shape come about. Not fear-based shape. So getting comfortable with the awkwardness or vulnerability or shakiness, being unsettled, and that can be a different kind of movement that's not necessarily so pushy, but it could still take you somewhere. There's a story of a king in India, King Janak, who had a dream of being a beggar, who was hungry, starving, living on the street. And someone kindly gave him some food. And he was so happy to have his food, he thought, let me take a bath and get ready and have my nice meal. And he put the food down and he was getting clean to enjoy his meal properly. And a dog came and grabbed his food. And he woke up and was a king in silk sheets. And he got a question. What is more real? The beggar whose food just got stolen by a dog, or the king in the silk sheets? So you can see it doesn't work to borrow someone else's question. We wouldn't get taken very far with that question, I don't think. It could happen that you have a dream and you wake up, or you're awake and you feel like it's a dream and a question starts that's yours. But for him, this question started and it really got to him. And because he was king, he could call all the wise, so-called wise people of the country to come and answer his question, which they couldn't because it was his question. So kind of opening to a different kind of caring, maybe. It can feel like urgency, worry and hurry and drive. But it's coming from somewhere deeper, even. And part of having our freedom is getting more in touch with the subtle layers of us so that we can feel kind of the call, the magnetism, like the inner gravity of that unsettling, freeing place where we might have a seemingly silly question. What is real? That dream or this dream? And the way the story comes to a conclusion is that the king tried all the people who had any kind of reputation for being able to answer questions, and they couldn't help him. And then there was this 8-year-old boy who also had some different shape in his body. He was called Ashtavakra. That means bent in 8 places. Who was saying, I can help. And this is a place inside us, Ashtavakra. Let's say an 8-year-old child with 8 things wrong with him from our point of view. Who dares to say, I can help? If you tried every other option, now you're listening. I can help. So we can wait till we're that desperate. Like sometimes people have issues and they try the conventional remedies and it doesn't work, and they try some more a little bit farther out remedies and it doesn't work, and then they're like, oh, well, maybe I'll try mindfulness. And it's good, at least let's do that. But also, if we could, rather than waiting to be desperate, also let this child inside, a childlike place that can help, have a voice. And we'll talk a little bit more about how that comes about soon. But noticing how, when we're aware we have an issue that's unresolved, we would tend to go to whoever we consider the authorities first. We care so much that then we go with fear rather than intuition. And so that's one like new set of muscles, so to speak, to start to use and find slowly how they might work. That because I care, I'm freaking out. Because I care, what could help me have enough space to feel my best guess at an intuition? Maybe distracting oneself for a while. Taking a nap, exercising, getting sweaty. So the boy, the child, said, I can give you what you need, which was a very particular kind of space. He didn't say that. I can give you what you need, but first you have to give me my teacher's price, which was the tradition, the dakshina. They had to have a bond if there were going to be a meeting with a teacher and a student. And the king was like, sure, like whatever. I have everything, so I can give you everything if you want. And it, of course, in India it was cows with gold-tipped horns and more gold and more gold. And the child said, that's actually, you know, that doesn't belong to you. You're the king, and the kingdom is in your care. The riches are for the people and the country, not for your personal disposal. You need to give me something that's yours. And so he said, okay, I give you me. I'll be your servant. And the child was so wise as to say, you don't belong to yourself. You have married. So you can't give your body away because you don't own it. Something that's yours that you can give. And you have to give it to me in the time it takes, putting one foot in the stirrup on the horse saddle, the foothold on one side. You have one foot in place. And the time you have to give me my gift, something that's yours, is the time it takes to get the other foot on the other side of the horse and the other stirrup foothold. Okay. Go ahead. And somehow the question had been boiling enough or cooking enough or softening enough or bringing about, you know, when things are so wild and crazy, you just start laughing. And something happened between putting one foot in and the other foot in. And I think it's not necessarily accidental that it was about a movement of the body, and especially of the feet and the legs. So this metaphor of finding ways to get the feeling back in our lower body is not just a metaphor. There was something that the king Janak found out in that moment that he had and could give. And that was its own answer. So, have you noticed when you're here trying to meditate and the fly comes to visit you? Or maybe a sound of snoring comes to visit? Or maybe some kind of other sensation in your body or some kind of other thought or memory or emotion in your mind and body. But let's say a fly. A fly lands and doesn't just stay still. It could so easily happen that you're suddenly with one pointed focus. The only sensation in the world is the fly's feet on your cheek, and now it's on your ear, and it's going in your ear. So one-pointed, except there's part of the mind that's saying, if only this fly would go away so I could, what? Find out what your what is. If only the fly would go away, it's distracting me from what? The fly is, with all of its strength, keeping me from what? What project? Then the fly does go away, and what happens? Suddenly it's gone, and what happens? What was it? Vedana. Afterwards? Before, during, and after, probably. Opening the project, maybe. Or completely forgetting that there was a project. More often. So someone mentioned Vedana. That's the way we filter experience, not on purpose. It just happens in a very primal way. So it can be really fun, actually, to play with, seriously, fly landing, because it's hopefully usually not painful to the body. You're not usually, I mean, maybe if it goes in your mouth, that would do some things that weren't so great. But if it's on your cheek or your leg or whatever, it can be intense, but it's probably not painful. But what can be painful is the interpretation in the mind of fly. So it's really interesting because the first primal reaction to the sensation is that it's not painful. But immediately the mind recognizes fly. I mean, what if it weren't a fly? What if you opened your eyes and there was just a string blowing in a breeze on your leg or whatever? Or a butterfly. We had that on the last retreat. The flies came up and someone had a fly go in her mouth. And she was like, and then imagining to herself, if it were a butterfly, what would I feel? So a lot of times what happens, the fly comes, our attention goes there, and we often would have a hard time stopping our attention from going there. And then the fly goes. And often there's not like an enthusiasm for coming into easeful spaciousness. Often what happens is the next kind of fly. Maybe not a literal insect, but a memory. Or the thought that I'm doing well or not doing well. I'm a great meditator, I'm a terrible meditator. Everybody else is da 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 da. Everybody else is like you, by the way. So when we're first getting to know or re-getting to know what it's like to have a more gathered attention and mind, sometimes it's just easier, and we often don't have another option than to pay attention to something unpleasant. That's what keeps happening, you might have noticed. It's something, it's a bit more solid, we've practiced feeling it more. And so we often go from one unpleasant to another unpleasant to another. From a fly to a memory to an emotion to a judgment, and then to another judgment and another judgment and a judgment of the judgment. So part of having our freedom is getting to know ourselves. When something unpleasant has our attention, and then it leaves, or we lie down and it's loose, or there's an out-breath, and at the end of the out-breath and after the out-breath, it's loose. And there's not a lot that's strongly grabbing our attention for a moment. And could we let ourselves land with something more subtle than what we're used to? And it will be awkward. But there's another part of having our freedom is kind of getting back a love of challenge. If you maybe know someone who's a musician, like really into it, or if you're really into something, really into it, you want to get to know it inside out. But if we imagine a musician who's really into it, and whether they're just improvising something or they're learning a piece someone wrote, we could imagine that it could be juicy for them. They would want to go right into the hardest part and really get into it, and over again. And it wouldn't have to be being hard on oneself or being pushed and driven. It could really be, if we can imagine how juicy it could be. Not because you're trying to be like someone else, but in yourself, what was that again, where it got shaky? Oh, that shakiness. And wanting to slow motion through there a few times maybe. And give all the support you could to come into that part that's not smooth for you. Does that make sense? Can you imagine? Not just wanting it to be over and easy and done and you got the certificate, but that it could be a long journey that you love how long it is. Because it's just a journey of you getting into what's juicy. Does it make sense? Yes. Going back to the child. If the child was lucky. So if you have done some sitting practice and you're playing with lying down, then you have a good chance to notice when you're sitting what's hard and what's easy about it. And when you're lying down, what's hard and what's easy about it. And part of what can be hard is that the ego, the separate sense of self, can't quite figure out what's happening. Can't quite get it to fit into a narrative about me. Except the narrative of, oh, I can't do it. Or something like that. But when we keep on practicing opening to an awareness that already is hearing and sensing, we keep on with the rediscovering some access of the person we are with something impersonal that kind of has our back and is also kind of feeding us sensations, sounds. It's hearing for us, it's feeling for us. Getting to know not just the relief of when the fly goes away. That's the relief from my own, we've so practiced being mesmerized. Mehup netim. Mesmerized, hypnotized. By what seems to be wrong, unpleasant, a problem. We can't stop paying attention to it. And then it's gone. There's a relief from our own fascination with the difficult and the problem and what's wrong. And then if from there we can give some permission in the same mood as relief, but not buying into the sense of like there's either me paying strong effort or I am on vacation. But there could be some energy that's really precise or subtle that's doing something that I'm discovering. That I'm allowing. I'm noticing that it's present, leaving space for it. Like Ashtavakra made space for Janak to fall in. So when we're occupied with something that our feeling tone is that it's wrong, noticing how that is, that tendency to be occupied with what seems to be wrong. And then when you're unoccupied, what do you imagine you would do when you're unoccupied, when you're free of that problem? What do you imagine you would do? And then what do you do? What does happen? So we can also use the example of the fly to notice the way that the mind occupies itself or occupies our landscape, our life energy. If you can remember a fly or imagine, or you have another example for yourself, the story that comes back, the inner critic that comes back, and all your attention, you believe it. It's not that you want to believe it, but it's got this magnetic. It seems real, it seems so believable. Can we maybe later on think back, and maybe eventually at the time, notice what kind of game are we playing? What bargain are we trying to make? If we're like, come on, fly, get off. Get off my face. So what? So that what? So I can focus on something else, so I can relax, so I can be. Anybody have an example? Either of a fly or of your bargain with the fly or with yourself around the fly. If the fly gets off, then I will be able to what? What was it?
Be idle.
Be idle. Stillness, be in stillness. Mm-hmm. Any other come to mind? Devoted to the process. What was it? Then I will enjoy life. Mm-hmm. I'll be content. Contentment will be. Do you know the word hypocrisy? Is it hypocrisia or something like that? By chance. It is? No. Biut? Sviut. Sviut. Okay.
Something is not real, it's color. So it's viut. The word seva is color.
Okay.
So
okay. So what I mean is like that, but really specific. The mind is saying, fly, get off me, so that then I can be in stillness. Because what I really love, what I'm all about, is stillness. I'm glad you're laughing. Fly, get off me so I can be in stillness. Because what I love is stillness, and what I'm all about is stillness. So just get off me. Sometimes with an actual movement that's not still. Get off me so I can be still. So we could call it hypocrisy, or we could call it postponement. We could call it fear of going with what we really love. Like really being, like you said, devoted to the process. Really being devoted to what we're devoted to, what we love. There's a response to stillness, and we can start to open ourselves up to loving stillness. And the hard part is that it's not quite the same, it's not an occupation. What we really love doesn't exist in that way and doesn't allow us to hold on to it. We would be holding on to an idea or a memory of something. And yet stillness as a quality is a real something real. And so we can't just go from that project to this project. When it's a project, again, we're postponing. loving what we love. So I'm not saying it's easy when there's a fly walking in your ear, but I am saying it's possible to practice and play with, here's this sensation, some attention is here, and love stillness, I love stillness, or there's love for stillness, or life loves stillness. Stillness is so good. I just want to say again, it's not going to work the way you will plan, because it's not just another project like the other ones. It's like we still can't feel our lower body, and we have the sense that it might be possible to feel our lower body, but no one can really tell us exactly how to. We just have ourselves, and what's going on is there seems to be a lower body. I can't feel it from the inside. I can reassure myself there's something here. My hands can say there's something here. And then through caring, or through why not? So caring without control and fear, without making it a project, caring can be why not? Or it can be being desperate. Or it can be being playful. It can be giving up. And then something spontaneous. And it can be also a portion of craft, like really working with instructions that are good enough, that fit you well enough. You start to get to know your material. So how? What is a body from the inside? What is a life from the inside? What is a mind from the inside? What are relationships from this inside? What are programming programs? Have you heard of Oliver Sacks? So, scientist and writer, I could say. And he had an accident and couldn't walk. And it was this situation of trying to figure out how to get the body to remember how to walk, which is so much like our situation, trying to find what could be a way to access our deeper resources. Like, what is it that's really mine? Or that's really not just formed by the outside? And there's a lot in that story. In case you're interested, look for it. But one thing that I loved was he found that he couldn't really do much walking. He couldn't really, it wasn't happening. And by chance, someone turned on some music. And as long as the music was going, somehow the body could walk. And so if you're kind of stuck in yourself, like, I can't crack the code with this emotional story or this whatever, inner critic, or this giving up, or this trying too hard, sadness, rage, shame, fear, insecurity, history, trauma, we all have all of that. We have the training that somehow I've got to find the answer alone, and alone seems to mean to us like in my little box of my upstairs self. So we're trying to kind of work with the upstairs self using the upstairs self. And it's just dry and dry. Or fiery and fiery. Or frozen and frozen. And so the example of music, something that might sound like it's not meditative or silent or, but it has some quality. So it could be something around joy, could be something around wholeness. It could be music. Or music as a metaphor. We could imagine that music would be a good metaphor for what Janak discovered between putting one foot and the other foot. Something like music inside himself. That in a way also isn't his, but it is given, like the generosity of life. It's not somebody else's. So please get to know the bargains you're trying to make or that your programs are trying to make, but don't spend more than 10% of your time on that because it's such an easy occupation to burn off your life stream on. Mostly you already know it, but getting it really clear, like in a sentence, or maybe there's 3 or maybe there's 100, but it clear, just that, that's what's going on. And often what it actually comes down to is something like, I have fear and I love love. And even love is scary, and loving love is scary. And can we be clear just there? Just being clear there. Or fear and whatever you love. Whatever feels like a home or if I could live in that. Anything else could happen and whatever. Doesn't matter. Another part of having our freedom has to do with sensitivity. And in our current culture, sensitivity, for the most part, becomes a problem. Because we're so removed from the earth. And if we let ourselves be the animals that we are and not be so against the life without which we're not alive. Human beings also were animals not so long ago. We could live in the freedom of that, somewhere between wild and tame. Like an animal feeling in all directions. Open to all that communication with the time of the day and the temperature of the air and the quality in a space and something starting to move inside. Sensitivity that starts to grow back in touch with life around us. Helps grow intuition. Intuition. And helps also grow beyond intuition to something even more direct, more sweet, more sensitive, more generous, where we don't have to filter even intuition through the mind. And again, if you find yourself, if you would describe yourself as sensitive, could it be possible not to take that as your personal issue, but a collective situation? And the remedy might include belonging as a kind of inner sense and also as a lifestyle. Belonging to the community of the earth. In literal ways as well as more subtle ways. Also maybe finding other words for the word sensitive or oversensitive. Some other words might be helpful. What's your experience? Sometimes it might be honest. Or it might be charged. And we need the lower body and the earth. And some friends. Or a friend. Or some music. And just gradually we can start to give ourselves enough space and tune into something more subtle. This question, what else, that I brought yesterday as maybe a headline of the retreat, one of them. So if we could go back to the hypocrisy, the bad deal that never has fulfillment. If you get off my face, then I'll be enlightened or whatever. In that bargain, there's some kind of investment in right and wrong, and should and shouldn't. So part of it might be that you're feeling really right, that there shouldn't be a fly in your face, and maybe also feeling really wrong, that you shouldn't be bothered by the fly in your face. Does that make sense? So if the fly is an old story that's come up, feeling really right and really wrong, no wonder it's stuck on repeat. That can include some guilt or shame in the resistance. So just kind of recognizing when guilt and shame come. If we invest in guilt and shame, we're voting to continue repeating what we're in right now. And if we could let that go inside out, discovering what it is that we're really called to, so a stillness, for example, or being. And noticing in the comfort zone of being with right and wrong as a way to orient ourselves and to feel that we exist. Even if I exist as the worst meditator in my mind, I'm the worst. Or maybe I'll be better than some of them, or maybe I'm the best. It's a way to feel that we exist in a more solid way. through right and wrong. Feeling what kind of pleasure is there in being right, or thinking that we're right, believing that we're right. Start with something small. Don't start with that time that someone really hurt you. That's more, needs more care. Maybe you've noticed something about the way things are organized here, and you have the thought, if this were my center, I would. Or how could they, whatever. Feel the rush of being right for a little while. And then check out the experience of being wrong, which most people are pretty addicted to. An addiction to the inner critic that causes so much suffering and like squashes so many voices. But is there something in us that kind of would rather turn to the story of being wrong than not be able to define what's happening? Than not have a seat for the ego? Or the comfort zone of being driven from a sense of lack inside a sense of separateness? And then checking out something we could call maybe meditative pleasure or childlike wonder kind of pleasure. The pleasure on the one side, when we're feeling separate, maybe small, or maybe from feeling small, putting yourself up as big. So a small kind of big. But often a small kind of small. And then what that self feels the right to have because I'm suffering so much. Or feels so helpless and needy. So addictive pleasure. Checking out in your addictions, including to the critic. Including to a sense of wrongness, and including to a sense of rightness. What goes on? And then pleasure that we could say maybe the pleasure of paradox, or sometimes I like to call it anti-addictive pleasure. The pleasure of looseness and I can't define what's happening. And the body releases sometimes into the ground and it feels good. And then maybe the mind that wants to be right and wants to know what's happening, or wants to be wrong and wants to insist that I can't know what's happening or I should, and release. And gravity, and it's good. In the goodness of meditative pleasure, we could call it, or just life goodness, I find that there are these paradoxes, like there can be a sense of being held. Sometimes it might be really nestled inside yourself, really somewhere secret or inner or deep or heartful. Sometimes it might be a sense of being held about this far away from your body. Like there's space, but there's also some containment here. Or there's the contact with the ground and wide space. Or sometimes spaciousness and timelessness. and the sense of contact might be more just in the richness and freedom of experience. If you remember or imagine, remember a moment that you might think of as timeless, which is a funny paradox to call a moment timeless. When that, you would just easily, naturally, not being too technical, say that that felt timeless. Maybe visiting a memory like that. Or maybe inviting yourself into timelessness. Sometimes it can help to play with this, coming to spaciousness and timelessness, where we're not driven. And even a storm of emotion could come through, or a storm of memories, a herd of memories could come through. And we can let that, like weather, just pass. We could even feel a sense of awe in the power, like we would with a storm. It's kind of a power of nature moment. But not particularly a problem with you. It might feel more like a clearing out of you, of what's not yours. Let it go. So playing with a practice of letting yourself, part of the paradox is there can be something very specific that we bring openness to. Let's say this bowl. It's a specific bowl, and we bring openness to it. Means it's not my ideas of bowls from before, but openness to this bowl or the light in these trees or the texture and taste of that mouthful of food. And letting the ideas kind of scatter like the herds of animals scatter. But it's still specific, and we bring openness. And there can come, I'm tempted to just let you try it first, but there can come a kind of meeting with anything. But maybe stick with things that are neutral to start with. Things you don't care too much one way or the other, things you don't invest in right and wrong beliefs about so much. Or things that are slightly pleasant can also work. But Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche talks about bringing down the vastness in a single sense perception. But just openness with a simple, specific object. Could be with seeing, it could be with anything, but maybe start with seeing or sound. Just openness. Letting the projects and the bargains drop. Letting something be good in the connection, the relationship, the seeing. And as you let the bowl be itself, maybe the bowl lets you be yourself a little more. And it can be another way to tap into something that's paradoxical and pleasant, specific and vast. And in the quality of timelessness and spaciousness, it's almost like we become the specific. We become the needle on the record. We become no longer defended and feeling separate. And our suffering opens a way. So lastly, I just want to mention that with the qualities of like something that's more of comfort and closeness and holding or being held or gathering, and often it can be both a sense of kind of being wrapped around with a little space and also having a center of inner gravity. And then from the inner gravity, spaciousness. But many times people have either a fear of the closeness or a fear of the spaciousness from the way your life was shaped. Or you just feel the spaciousness or openness, where's the contact? Or you just feel the contact, where's the space? So gradually letting yourself grow to include the paradox of being a specific form, specific mind and body, with specific history. And that by going in, we may discover no longer separateness in a way where we still have space. It doesn't mean we're exposed to whatever anybody wants to say or do. There's still space. And just starting small, playing with what experiences you can currently remember or notice while they're happening. These are subtle experiences, most easily forgotten compared to the suffering, compared to the problems, compared to the right and wrong. When something just is without right and wrong, it doesn't land in the recording department. And it's only when we're a little bit in the same frequency again that it may come back to mind like a dream. Oh, yeah. But working with whatever you have access to, a memory of a feeling of timelessness or stillness or your words, or playing with the word space or spacious, literal and inner, and playing with feelings and experiences of contact, like you and the earth, kindness and your pain. Slowly, like finding these two legs, letting them start to walk together. Specific and close and comfortable and held, and more the quality of love. And then also, without contradiction, without problem, vastness, sky-like spaciousness. Thank you for being here. And it's really such an honor to be in the room with all of your paths that have brought you here and all of your practice these days. It's really amazing. Thank you.